This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Recently, as always, there was some more information about diets in the news. This one particularly talked about a New England Journal of Medicine study talking about a low-carbohydrate diet, a low-fat diet, and a Mediterranean diet. Really, if you look at this study pretty closely, there was not a lot of difference in the amount of fat intake between the groups. There was a small amount of weight loss, a moderate weight loss over 2 years, with the biggest group losing about 10 pounds in 2 years. So, you know, you want to be careful about interpreting too much on these kinds of diets, and I'm not sure it supports either any of these dramatically, other than if you make an effort, you can lose some weight. And which comes to my point, there's some basics about weight loss that I've talked about on the program before. I think we need to talk about it again. It's weight loss is always an energy issue, and diets are just ways that people may find that helps them take in less energy. You have a normal amount of caloric expenditure every day, just living and working and doing normal behavior. You can increase that energy expenditure by doing some extra exercise, and you match that expenditure by what you take in. If you're overweight and you take in the same number of calories you burn every day, you don't lose any weight. To lose weight, you have to take in less calories than you burn up. If you're gaining weight, you're taking in more calories than you're burning up. It's just that simple. Another important factor to keep in mind is it takes about 3,500 calories deficit to really lose a pound. Everyone who's ever gone on a significant diet knows in the first week or so you can lose quite a bit of weight, maybe 2, 3, 5 pounds. But that's mainly water weight. Real weight loss of more than 2 pounds a week, if you sit down and do the figuring, is very, very difficult. So for example, if you're a 2,000 calorie a day need, and you're on a 1,000 calorie a day diet, you're having a 1,000 calorie a day deficit. That's a pound every 3.5 days by just cutting your calories in half. So it's important to eat less, exercise more, and one other important thing, fat has twice as many calories per gram as proteins are sugars, which are also called carbohydrates. Many people may guess carbohydrates have more calories, but actually fats have about twice as much. So simply cutting the fat intake and eating a little less and exercising more and doing it, and here's maybe the most important thing, consistently will help all of us lose in our weight and maintain what we've got. What we're talking about today has very little to do with weight. My guest is Nancy Whitney. Nancy is the clinical director of the Seattle Parent-Child Assistant Program, which is part of the Fetal Alcohol and Drug Unit at the University of Washington School of Medicine. We're going to be talking mainly about fetal alcohol syndrome with Nancy. Ms. Whitney, welcome to Line One.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So let's, before we get into fetal alcohol, let me just ask you specifically what it is you're doing and how long you've been working with the drug unit so we know a little bit about you and what your day-to-day activities are.
Okay. Well, I've been here at the Parent-Child Assistance Program for almost 8 years now. I am a master's level therapist. I'm a licensed mental health counselor here in the state of Washington. And the Parent-Child Assistance Program is a state-funded program that we have throughout the state of Washington, 9 teams total, that provide intensive case management for moms with significant substance abuse problems who have delivered a child or are currently pregnant. So we work with the highest risk moms for a period of 3 years, helping refer and connect them to services that will help them be clean and sober and hopefully good parents to their children.
And I assume, well, I partly assume this, but partly from getting on your websites and looking at this, all came about as kind of an effort to control the problems we were seeing with drug and alcohol use during pregnancy.
Yeah, it started, of course, Dr. Streisguth has been studying fetal alcohol effects since the mid-1970s. And so her research is, you know, over 30 years old now and is ongoing. And in the 80s, the popular problem was pardon my term, but that's what they used, crack babies.
Mm-hmm.
So the effects of cocaine in utero was something that the unit was studying in the 1980s. And what became really evident to the researchers at that time was that substance abuse comes with a whole lot of problems in the family. And just telling somebody to quit doing drugs and alcohol wasn't enough. That if we wanted to really prevent the future births of drug and alcohol-affected children, we really needed to get into the family and help them with their other problems, which can include poverty, domestic violence, untreated mental health disorders, lack of education, multi-generational substance abuse. I mean, it's just a whole cohort of problems that create this cycle over and over again. So our job is to break the cycle and hopefully create clean and sober, healthy moms.
It seems to me, as a pediatrician, that there is still a lot of focus on drug use during the harm of doing drug abuse during pregnancy. But perhaps I don't hear as much, at least in the lay literature, on alcohol. Is that true? And is it true, do you think, because we've kind of gotten the message out, or you've gotten the message out about alcohol and drinking and pregnancy?
Yes and no. I think that that the message is out there to not drink during pregnancy. I think most women know that, and they have known that since the mid-1980s. I think that there are still a lot of misconceptions about how much is safe to drink. It is not uncommon for me to hear from my clients that the doctor has told them that this much is okay or that much is okay, whereas the AMA says no alcohol at all is a safe amount during pregnancy. But we're also, for the most part, talking about addiction. And when we start talking about addiction, that sort of leaves those normal soccer moms behind and into a whole new world. When we start talking about the other drugs, there's a lot of stigma attached in our society about illegal drugs, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine being the three popular ones right now. And it's true that to do these things during pregnancy is not good for the baby, in the sense that it's an increased risk of miscarriage, it's an increased risk of premature labor, preterm labor, premature babies, low birth weight, all of which come with their own set of problems. But when we look at those kids down the road, 4 or 5 years old, they don't have brain damage. They don't have, there's no syndrome for cocaine or heroin. Well, alcohol is definitely a teratogen that causes birth defects, and it is a lifetime disability for those children.
Hmm. Okay.
We try not to let that out too
much. Yeah.
But the bottom line is, if you have to choose between cocaine and alcohol,
mm-hmm.
choose cocaine.
Mm-hmm. Having said that so succinctly, let's clarify that one more time. And the reason you would say that is there are long-term consequences of alcohol at the right time in the developing nervous system or the developing fetus, whereas with cocaine, that has not been shown to be the case.
Exactly. Absolutely. Does not cause brain damage.
It's interesting because I would say I think there's pretty good evidence that just cigarette smoking, I know, is associated with smaller babies. It's associated with smaller conducting airways in the lungs and so forth, which can lead to increased episodes of wheezing, cough, pneumonia in early in childhood. So,
right. Lots of long-term consequences. Next to alcohol, smoking is the next worst thing.
Okay. All right. Well, let me give our number out. I want people who have questions or comments about the program today have plenty of warning about how to get a hold of us. In Anchorage, if you want to call us directly, it's 550-8433, 550-8433. You'll get one of our engineers. You can leave a question, which they'll forward to us, or we'll talk to you directly on the air. If you're outside of Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can also reach us by sending an email to lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, no spaces, lineone, at kska.org. Also remember that the program is live now in Anchorage between 2 and 3. If you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. Perhaps we ought to back up just a second, Ms. Whitney, and let's define and ferret out a little bit better what we mean by fetal alcohol syndrome.
Okay. So syndrome means a collection of symptoms that come together to form the disorder. So in our case, when we're talking about fetal alcohol syndrome, we're talking about four main factors that come together to give a person that diagnosis. The first is the documented use of alcohol during pregnancy by the mom. So that can often be difficult when we're looking at older adults because their mom may not be around to answer that question. But we need to have some sense that she did, in fact, drink during her pregnancy. Then we go into the rest of the diagnosis, which includes the classic features of the fetal alcohol face. There are three things that we're kind of looking at with that face. One is a very thin upper lip. And then right above the lip, there's this dent that we all have, a couple of ridges. And that's called the philtrum. And in a fetal alcohol face, that philtrum will be smooth, less pronounced, making it look like there's a big distance, basically, between their lips and the bottom of their nose. And then their eyes are smaller, which makes them look like they're kind of far apart. So those are the main features of a fetal alcohol face. They are present in pretty much any animal study that you want to show where you give alcohol. They will show up, whether it's mice or monkeys or chickens. The same things happen to the face when they are exposed to alcohol. The second thing we're looking at in terms of the diagnosis and the effects on the fetus is growth. So to get a diagnosis of FAS, they have to hit less than or equal to the 10th percentile in height and or weight. So these folks tend to be small early on, and they tend to stay small at least up until puberty. And then the final one is the effects on the central nervous system, which is usually evidenced by different motor skill tests, speech delays, cognitive behavioral issues that can be measured in a variety of ways depending on the age of the person. So all of those need to be present at the highest level for a person to receive a full diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome.
All right. We have a caller on the air. It looks like it's Jennifer, and she has some questions about the question you may or the point you may have made about cocaine. So let me get her since we've just been talking about it. Jennifer, you on line one?
Hi, this is Jennifer.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Well, I'm a former educator and had to do drug education, so I'm pretty astounded at the fact that cocaine or those types of drugs don't affect the fetus. I'm just wondering what study this came from and how big the study was and if it was put out in a major scientific or professional journal.
Yeah, first off, always we got to be very, very careful when we talk about specifics. There was nothing said that cocaine doesn't affect the fetus. The issue, as I recall, and I'll let Nancy comment, is long-term permanent sequelae, particularly nervous system, structural parts of the body, and that's different between cocaine and alcohol. Now, Nancy, you tell me if I'm off limits here.
No, you're absolutely right. What we're talking about, Jennifer, is the presence of permanent brain damage as measured by cognitive behavioral, as measured by CAT scans or MRI scans. When you control for a lot of the other factors that you may be looking at when you're looking at a child that's cocaine exposed. So if you can control for poverty, nutrition, reactive attachment disorder, the other kinds of things that may be involved, the fact is that these kids don't really look any different than kids that are not exposed, with a couple of exceptions. One of those exceptions is they do tend to have a higher incidence of ADD or ADHD. And other kinds of learning disabilities. But when you work with these folks like I do on a day-to-day basis, you soon figure out that their parents often have those kinds of problems that have been undiagnosed and untreated, and those are highly genetic disorders. So I can't tell you that a kid at 5 years old who is looking ADD and was also cocaine exposed, that it was caused by the cocaine. And we have a lot of research over the years. I'm not the epidemiologist in our team, so I can't quote you Bible and verse, but these are very consistent studies, both in terms of animal studies and across several longitudinal studies from many researchers over the years. It does affect the fetus during pregnancy in the sense that moms who are doing crack don't take very good care of themselves. They don't sleep. Okay. They don't eat right. So you do end up with things like preterm labor, prematurity, low birth weight, and those things can have effects on the child long term, but they would be caused by the poor in utero environment as opposed to the actual cocaine exposure. Does that make sense?
Okay. It does. I just dropped in. I didn't see hear the beginning of it. I dropped in on the final comment. And
no, great.
Yep.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
You bet.
Okay, bye.
All right, and I'm going to take a second here. This is really, really important. When we in science, it's very important to make sure we're dealing and talking about apples and not apples and oranges, and definitions
right.
become very important. And confounding variables are the big issue here. Is there's lots of other baggage that a cocaine-exposed baby may have that
right.
may cause problems which may not be related directly to cocaine. And that's where it's difficult, it's hard, time-consuming, expensive research, but that's what the best answer is right now, is that we don't see those long-term effects like we do with alcohol.
And we have the animal studies to fall back
yeah,
on.
Yeah, and that's
so you get to control for all those things.
Right, right. And one way you look at it is you see if there are long-term effects on animals with alcohol. And so in a sense, there is some good news in the sense that at least cocaine-exposed babies and other drugs may have a better prognosis if you can control and alleviate those other confounding variables. Not true necessarily for fetal alcohol syndrome.
That's absolutely true. We do have some protective things that we want to try to get for a child that we know is alcohol exposed.
Right.
The two most predictive protective factors are a stable home environment and early diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Which correlates with almost all chronic disease.
Yeah, but it's harder, but getting early diagnosis with fetal alcohol is very, very challenging.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. All right, so we're back to these diagnostic things that are important for making the diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome is, one, you have to have documented use during pregnancy. One, there's some characteristic changes in the face, smaller appearing eyes, a larger, flatter philtrum area, the area between the upper lip and the nose, some central nervous system effects that can be documented, and an effect on growth at least through adolescence.
Right.
And so now those are required for a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome, but we
right.
hear things called fetal alcohol effect and neurodevelopmentally related problems associated with alcohol and so forth. What are these gray areas trying to say?
Well, first of all, FAS is the only one that's an actual medical diagnosis that can be given sure. by a doctor. The rest of them are more descriptive of the idea that we've all come to acknowledge, is that even if the face and the growth are not present, because those are most affected at certain times during development in the pregnancy, the central nervous system is affected during the entire pregnancy. So there's no time that's okay for the brain development for alcohol, whereas if you don't drink in the first trimester, you may not get the face. If you don't drink in the third trimester, you might not get the growth problems. But central nervous system damage occurs throughout the entire pregnancy. So we have this group of people which don't meet criteria for a diagnosis because they don't have one or both of those other factors, the face and the growth. But they do have significant cognitive or neurobehavioral problems. And they, in a lot of ways, look exactly the same as fetal alcohol syndrome folks. So we're trying to sort of, all of these other descriptions are some sort of recognition that there are these other folks out there with similar challenges. And in some ways, we call it a hidden disability because they don't have the big red flags that scream, I'm FAS. And they're trying to make it through our school systems and in life every single day.
Let me remind our listeners once again, if you've got questions or comments about the program today on fetal alcohol syndrome, please give us a call, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. The toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, or you can email at line1@kska.org. And also remember, you can go to kska.org and subscribe, and each week you'll get the most recent Line 1 update, or you can refer friends to kska.org to listen to the podcast later if you people you want to have listening to it are not available at this particular time. I want to get to this issue about the neurocognitive effects and how important that is in society and also all and for sure. But I want to ferret out, in my own mind at least, this issue of no amount of alcohol is safe for the developing fetus. Mm-hmm. And the reason I want to is I think that's a frightening, sometimes scary thing for mothers to think about, if for no other reason that most pregnancies, I'm not sure exact, I knew the statistic one time because we've talked about unplanned pregnancies, but many pregnancies are unplanned. So by right. the time a woman knows she's pregnant, she may well have had a beer, a glass of wine, something during a very, very early part of the fetal development, which is
right.
pretty important period of time. So
yeah.
talk to us about this issue.
So first of all, nationwide, 57% of all pregnancies are unplanned. So unplanned does not necessarily mean unwanted. It could be people who just didn't care if they got pregnant or not. It could be failed birth control. But for the matter, we're talking about 57%. The majority of all pregnancies are unplanned. So if a woman is, in fact, drinking during the early stages of pregnancy and doesn't know it, there is some risk. The question is how much is a risk? And we can't say for sure for any single person because it's entirely too complicated. There's the mom's protective factors. There's the father's protective factors in terms of genes, and it might not be protective. They might be increased risks. So when you put those sort of genes together and swirl them, we don't know, you know, is that baby going to be more at risk than another baby along the way with the same alcohol exposure? What we do know is that a binge drinking episode is more damaging than, say, drinking one a day for a period of time. So if a woman drinks four or five drinks in a single setting, so that's five shots, five beers, five glasses of wine in a single setting in an evening, say, that is considered an increased risk for fetal alcohol effects, especially if that's repeated week after week after week.
Okay.
However high her blood alcohol level gets, the fetus's blood alcohol goes higher.
Okay.
And however long it takes her to process that alcohol out of her system, it takes the fetus that much longer because of the size. So what we definitely want to avoid as much as possible is a binge pattern of drinking. And what we do tell people is if you can get pregnant, as in, you know, of childbearing age and not using birth control, then please don't drink.
Okay.
And if you do drink, then please don't get pregnant.
Okay. All right. So, again, what we're hoping people are listening to very, very, very carefully is the honest answer is nobody knows how little alcohol at the right time could cause an effect.
Right.
So the obvious answer is don't drink when you might become pregnant.
Yep. There's some really weird mouse studies that they did over the years where they would give a female pregnant mouse heavy alcohol dose on the seventh day of gestation. And of the litter that she had, two of them maybe would have fetal alcohol syndrome and the other six wouldn't.
Right. Right.
So just don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure that this is the right place for this, but there's an increasing amount of information coming out on a branch of genetics called epigenetics. And one of the questions I had is perhaps do teratogens work through an epigenetic mechanism? And by that, what I mean is there are environmental influences that are now very clearly demonstrable on our genome. And so twins aren't exactly in every inch of the degree exactly the same. In fact, each of us have different fingerprints on one hand than the other. So we're not perfectly identical, which raises the question, is some things in the environment can't have them. So it gets extremely, extremely complex in looking at these issues. But the bottom line is, particularly alcohol can be a problem. It raises another question in my mind. Again, we're getting a little bit off the subject, perhaps. But alcohol is transmitted in fatty materials pretty well. That's why we get inebriated. Our brain's got a lot of fat. Our breast milk has a lot of fat. A human baby, in my mind, is continuing to have neurologic development after birth. Moms may breastfeed. Alcohol gets into breast milk extremely well. It gets into the baby extremely well. What do we know about fetal brain development and effects after pregnancy associated with breastfeeding?
You know, I don't know that anybody's done specific studies about that, and I don't know of any animal studies where they've just done exposure during the postnatal period. But we can, I think, extrapolate from just what you've said, that it does cross into the breast milk, and we know that babies' brains are still rapidly expanding and developing up until the age of 3. For at least, and there's some, you know, slow in growth after that, but still huge amounts of growth up until the age of 3. So significant alcohol impacts or affects intakes. I'm having trouble with English language all of a sudden. a significant alcohol intake by the mother while breastfeeding would have an impact on the child if there was breastfeeding during that period where the alcohol is in the breast milk. And I think that some OBGYNs will talk with moms about don't drink, you know, this many hours previous to or prior or after breastfeeding.
Okay. One more question before we get to these developmental issues. Is there a more critical period than other during the time an infant is developing in the uterus for the likelihood of significant effects from alcohol exposure? Is the first couple of weeks, is the first trimester, the second trimester, and so forth? Is there one more important?
You know, again, I think that the central nervous system effects are throughout the entire pregnancy.
Okay.
I think that most people would say the sooner you quit drinking, the better. And that significant use during the first trimester is going to be the highest risk time, because that's when those brain cells are first really figuring out where they need to go and what they need to do.
Okay. All right. So now let's focus on these central nervous system effects. We may have some facial characteristics. There's probably little, if anything, we can do other than they help us make a diagnosis. There's the growth effects, which we can't do much about, and helps us make a diagnosis. But we've got these central nervous system effects. So let's ferret those out. What do we know about those and how they affect children in the first several years of life, and then we'll work our way up through adulthood and the consequences throughout life.
Okay. Well, to start with, a baby who is fairly alcohol-affected is going to have certain characteristics from the get-go, and when, especially if we're talking full-blown FAS. And some of those characteristics are going to be not being able to habituate to stimulus. So they get very startled at sound, at light, and while most babies will adapt to those things in their environment as they become used to them, a fetal alcohol affected child won't. They constantly are startled and need a much quieter environment and a less stimulating environment than an average baby. They also may have feeding difficulties. Swallowing, they may not like the feel of food in their mouth. They may have acid reflux and sort of look colicky at times. So they often have trouble gaining weight after birth because you just can't keep food in them and you can't get them to feed on a regular basis. They also have, as part of that habituation problem, they may not like the feel of their clothes. They may not like their diaper. They may not like the onesies. They may not like the blankets. They seams will bother them, and so they're sort of happy or naked sometimes. So those all combine to a baby that is really, really fussy and really difficult for mom to manage until she gets some help with those things.
Okay. Okay.
Just because those things aren't evident at birth, however, does not mean that the child doesn't have brain damage and it won't show up later.
Right. And is the converse of that true, that there may be babies who are having trouble adapting to reflexes and tight clothing and are just poor adapters to the environment from a, I would use the word temperament standpoint. There's differences. Brazelton used to flash lights in babies' eyes, and some would fuss and some wouldn't. Some would scream for longer periods than others. So there's this background of different temperaments, and I don't want to have people jumping to conclusions too much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, everybody does have their temperament, and there are other reasons for those things to occur. I mean, there's now something called sensory integration disorder, which those kids are going to show those things as well. But when we know that there's been alcohol exposure, then it's sort of okay to say that's where this is coming from.
Right, right. And so I see a baby who is irritable, fussy, hard to feed, very frustrating, particularly for a first-time mother.
Oh, yeah.
Very demanding on the environment.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And will probably continue to be for the rest of her life.
All right. So take us up a little bit further along. We're also bound by problems in a two-month-old. We may have developmental milestones, and we may make some characteristics, but we can't predict how well their attention is, what their calculability is, how well they can do other things. So take us on up through early childhood a little bit and the kind of characteristic things you might see.
Yeah. So we are going to start looking for those developmental milestones. The baby that doesn't crawl, the baby that doesn't walk or stand up on their own, they're a little far behind in those things. Balance, fine motor skills are often affected, and that can go on for long periods of time into adolescence and adulthood. The other things that happen can be that sort of sensory integration stuff starts to manifest its way in what we might call the terrible twos to the nth degree. You know, they're just completely frustrated all of the time. They have a hard time getting their needs met. They can't get around. They can't talk. So you see a lot of tantrums, and biting is a very common thing that I see in these kids. So as they get older, the sort of attention stuff becomes an issue, too, in the sense of can they pay attention to instructions? There's another thing that happens with these kids in that you'll start seeing 4, 5, 6 years old and up into the school age, which is sort of a faulty filing system with memory. They may be able to perform a certain task really well on some days, and then the next day it's completely gone. And it's very frustrating for teachers and for their parents because they'll say things like, "You're not trying hard enough. I know you know this stuff." And these kids just can't access it because it just doesn't get stored in a way that they can get it back out of their brain when they need it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing these kinds of things can be very difficult. Let's say, well, I guess my question is, you've got a child that's presenting to a pediatrician or a psychologist, psychiatrist, with some behavioral problems, attentional issues. They pick up on maybe some of this memory thing. But, you know, the question is that specific to fetal alcohol? We don't have the history. We don't remember that specifically. And everybody wants to know why this person, this child, is doing these particular things. Are these findings specific to fetal alcohol enough that we could say, well, almost certainly this syndrome of neurologic problems suggests very, very strongly that there is a fetal alcohol effect? Or could this be just an end result from many different kinds of things, including genetics and other exposures and so forth?
Well, I think that the ADHD symptoms, that sort of not being able to pay attention, sit still, that kind of stuff is very much something you'll see in other things. I mean, kids are ADHD because their dad is ADHD, and that's just, you know, right, that's the way it is. There is that memory thing is something that I think that is very unique to fetal alcohol effects.
Okay. Right.
You see teachers and their parents just saying over and over again, "Why don't they get it? Why don't they get it? Why do they keep doing the same stupid thing over and over again?" And so there's not only this sense of they don't understand and learn from their mistakes, I hate to hear people say they don't learn from their consequences because it makes them sound somewhat sociopathic. But but really, it's just a bad filing system. If you ask them ahead of time, they'll be able to give you the right answer. They just can't access it at the time that they need it. There's also some impulsiveness that is somewhat the same as regular ADHD, but again, somewhat unique to fetal alcohol effects because it goes along with that sort of not getting it kind of thing that people describe in working with them.
Okay. All right, I want to move on into later childhood, but let me also remind our listeners that if you have questions about what you're listening to today, give us a call. 550-8433 is our local number, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Our local number again, 550-8433. So I'm seeing a picture of a child who's been a difficult baby, now beginning to get in towards school. Maybe he's had a tough time in the terrible twos, as you defined it. Now we've got this issue with behavior, and on top of that, we're noticing that there's some access to some of the work we've done in the past. It's not so easy. We're impulsive, so I'm not thinking school is going to go real good.
School doesn't go very well, and in fact, over 70% of them have what we call a disrupted school experience, and that is they get expelled or they get suspended on a regular basis. I actually had a kindergartner diagnosed FAE who was expelled on his very first day of kindergarten because he said something very impulsively that the teacher didn't took too seriously, and that was her response. So so they have a really hard time in school. They have a hard time getting along with their peers. They have horrible anger management issues, and there's even some research that when they have these sort of anger outbursts, that it looks a little bit like a temporal seizure in the temporal lobe of their brain, that they'll tell you afterwards they have very little recollection of what set them off or what they said or did during the rage, and they really do lose control of themselves during this time. So, you know, this is, I'm describing a severely affected child. There is certainly shades of gray down towards the other end, but these are the kids that will throw chairs and get into fist fights, and they also are very sensitive to peer pressure, so it's very likely that they'll fall in with the wrong crowd and be made the fall guy. So they will end up probably in the juvenile justice system as a result of that. They have a sense that they don't fit in very well. So there's a real strong desire for somebody to like them. And if they think somebody's picking on them or staring at them, they're very likely to have outbursts as a result of that. So they really can be quite a handful when we start getting into school age. And the problem is, of course, is that they're going to end up in special ed classes just based on behavioral problems. And they probably will not have had any special testing to identify them. And the testing that school districts generally use isn't probably going to be helpful because the majority of these kids, especially when we're talking, well, if we're talking FAS, about 25% of them have a normal or above normal IQ. And if we're talking just fetal alcohol affected, probably two-thirds of them have a normal or above normal IQ. And the majority of them will not qualify on an IQ basis for developmental disability services. And here in the state of Washington, it's an IQ of 70 or below, and the majority of them are going to be above that. So their traditional tests aren't going to pick up what's going on with these kids' brains in any way, shape, or form. But they'll get tossed into special ed because that's just where they think they can manage them. And unfortunately, asking if the mom drank during pregnancy is not something that's routine in any of our networks at all, not in primary care, not in school districts. It's just not on people's radar.
Right, right. All right, so we're late school. Now we're heading towards high school. As you mentioned, we've got typically the teenager who wants to be accepted. This is a person who is probably struggling to be accepted and has some peer pressure, and you've already mentioned begins to have perhaps some relationship problems with the law as well and acting out. So take us a little bit further down the trip.
Chances are by the time that they're 15, 16 years old, they're probably not in school anymore. They may be confined in some way. The majority of them are confined either in hospitals or group homes or jails. A large number of them are in some kind of dependent living situation so that they are maybe being closely supervised by their parents or some other kind of system in that way. They're probably about, I think, 20% of them or so are going to be into drugs and alcohol by this time, which seems like a low number to me, but when you see that most of them are in some sort of dependent living situation, it's really hard to get into that stuff when somebody's watching you all the time. So they're likely to be involved in the justice system. They're probably not going to be able to hold down a job. They're probably not going to be engaged in any kind of formal education, especially not college or job training. And again, these are the most affected people. It kind of goes down in shades of gray from there. But they have a pretty chaotic and disrupted life.
All right. And how far have we followed, you know, accurately? You said the researchers there at the University of Oregon have been doing things for 30 years. Do we have some adult outcome kinds of situations, or do we just kind of extrapolate what we think is going to
be? No, actually, one of Dr. Streisku's first studies that she started way back in the 1970s, we refer to it as the Seattle 500 study. And what she did back in the mid-1970s was she identified 500 mothers here in the Seattle area. And she enrolled them in the study while they were pregnant, while they were in their prenatal care. And so in the mid-70s, we didn't know anything about alcohol exposure. And so people were more readily open about those kinds of things in those days in interviews than they are now. And then she followed those babies at birth and brought them in regularly, some of them up until the age of 35. And so we have complete psychosocial histories, and we have routine cognitive, behavioral, and neurological testing on these folks over the past 30-some-odd years. And some of them have no alcohol. Of the 500, some have no alcohol exposure. Some have extreme alcohol exposure, and everywhere in between. So we're really able to look at, if you want to call it, dose-related outcomes. And what we do know is that heavy alcohol use during pregnancy resulted in the kinds of things that I've talked about today, all in, way into adulthood. And that's why we're also able to say, what are the protective factors? And things, you know, if the kid got, say, taken away from mom and bounced around the foster care system, the outcomes for that kid didn't work out so well.
Mm-hmm.
If the kid was able to maintain a stable home environment, got an early diagnosis, and got a lot of early interventions as they grew up, then the outcome was better for them.
Let me just throw out a couple of statistics, perhaps, and one just for people that are listening to understand how frequently this diagnosis is being made, and gives you some feeling about the importance of the issue. I've got fetal alcohol syndrome, spectrum disorders, I'm trying to be very
right.
specific, is 1 in 100
right.
live births, about
right.
40,000.
1% of all babies have fetal alcohol effects of some kind, including FAS.
So that's 1 in 100. That's a pretty significant numbers,
yep.
and it's probably,
yep.
this is the leading known preventable cause of mental retardation and birth defects.
That's exactly right. And it costs almost $1 million to raise a child with fetal alcohol effects over their lifetime.
And a question that might come up in somebody's mind then is, can these effects be reversed? Have there been any studies showing that you clearly can reverse the effects or dramatically change the outcome, is another way of saying this, maybe?
Well, boy, that's a loaded question because you know, I mean, it's so let's use an example. If a 55-year-old guy has a stroke and has brain damage as a result of that stroke, and he has, you know, he can't talk and he can't use the right side of his body. We know that He has brain damage. We know that his brain is no longer developing. In fact, it's sort of on the downhill slide at that point. But do we just sort of write him off and say, sorry, dude, you're just going to have to not walk and talk for the next the rest of your life? We know that if we give that person speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy, that they will recover some function and be okay to some degree. So I think that when we start talking about babies, what we truly believe is that the earlier we get to them, the more likely we are to ameliorate some of these problems, and especially around the motor skill stuff. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, feeding therapy, speech therapy, given before the age of 3, I think will have significant impacts. In fact, I have one baby that we've worked with who was diagnosed with FAS at the age of 8 months. He was the second youngest child ever diagnosed at the Fetal Alcohol Clinic here at the UW. And we knew that he had brain damage because he was part of a pilot study where we used ultrasound to look at his corpus callosum. And he was missing one-third of his corpus callosum due to alcohol exposure. So starting at 4 months of age, he began physical therapy, even though he was too young to really be doing anything about it at that point in time. By the time he was 8 months old, his motor skill delays were very mild, and by the time he was 2.5 years old, there were no motor skill delays at all. Now, did he turn out to be the perfect child? No. He's like almost 7 now. He has significant ADHD-type symptoms. He's very impulsive. Problem-solving and executive function and adaptability are all still really challenging. But had we done nothing, I think he'd be a lot worse off.
And just to focus on the earlier the better, is that the theory is that the brain is very plastic. That is, that it
Absolutely.
Can be molded, and that areas where there's been damage right. can be circumvented by other parts
right.
of the brain if we
yes.
manage that appropriately.
Those little neural pathways are still right. figuring out what they need to do. And so if one part's not working, we can get another part to take on that task.
We don't think about it, but I've used this example to my parents a lot, is that human animals are the only animal that continues to have neurologic development outside of the uterus. That may not be entirely, but if you think about it, rabbits, horses, gerbils, everybody, they're doing all they're going to
yeah,
do pretty
yeah.
quickly, and
yeah.
we've got 80% of our adult brain size not until about age 2.
That's right.
showing there's
That's
some
right.
significant things going on
it's
outside
real cute,
of the
so that we take care of them.
You mentioned some imaging studies. I can't help but want to ask about functional MRI. Now we've got functional MRIs looking at everything, so I assume fetal alcohol syndrome has been looked at.
Yeah, there's been a lot of studies, and of course I can't quote them chapter and verse, but we have the FAS clinic here at the UW has done some work and specifically looking at memory. So for folks who are not familiar with functional MRIs, functional MRI allows you to see what part of the brain is activated while you're giving the patient tasks to do, look at pictures, recite poems, or whatever other kinds of things you are more controlled than that. But it does let us see what is the brain doing or not doing. And so functional MRIs have shown us that they, in fact, do have really poor memory problems. They have poor behavioral regulation. They have poor executive function. We can look at what parts of the brain should be activated for motor skills and balance that aren't activated because they're just not working right. So really the big message with both MRIs and functional MRIs is that these are structural and biochemical permanent changes in the brain that occur because of alcohol damage, and you just can't tell the kid to get over it and try harder because their brain just doesn't work right.
Another question that comes up that probably needs to be addressed directly, say a child grows up, has significant fetal alcohol effects, gets pregnant, it's a woman, and she has a child. Is that child affected by fetal alcohol-like problems?
FAS is not hereditary. It is completely and totally caused by the in utero environment that the fetus is developing in. So as long as mom doesn't use during her pregnancy, that will be a healthy baby in terms of brain development. The challenge becomes having an FAS mom parenting, and we've seen different experiences with that, having an impaired mom taking care of a normal child.
And that kind of, I guess, in a sense, relates back to mothers who don't know how to parent, have never been exposed to good parenting, are very unlikely to be correct in their parenting.
You know, I've had kids with speech delays that were perfectly normal births, and I'm like, what's going on? It's because an FAS mom doesn't know how to role model on how to teach a kid to talk. We have to give her very specific tasks. So FAS brains really lack the ability for abstract thinking and extrapolation and executive function stuff. So unless you sort of like sit down and role model it and give them step-by-step instructions on how to do it, it's really just not going to come naturally to them.
This question may be, again, more from my own personal interest, but on your website you talk about a photographic analysis software. I assume that there has been some software developed that helps providers, clinicians, make a more precise diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome and effects by computer algorithms that look at facial characteristics.
Yeah, the facial recognition pattern that was developed by Dr. Astley's clinic at the FAS clinic here at the UW. And she does make it available. And it's sort of a way to, well, the way we've used it here in the state of Washington is that every child going into long-term foster care has their picture taken and submitted for computer analysis. And if they hit the red flags in terms of those three facial features that we've talked about, they are then referred to the clinic for more in-depth testing and to see if they will qualify for a full-blown diagnosis. The danger in that, that I hear over and over again, is they don't have the face, so they're fine.
Right.
And I've heard that from, you know, child protective workers all the time, which sort of, again, you know, the people who qualify for FAS are a small number of the people who are actually running around with neurological damage because of alcohol exposure.
Which really, in a sense, I guess, gets us back to where we started. We've got about 6 minutes or so, Nancy, just to give you a warning. But I keep we're back to where we often are, is that prevention is cheaper than the cure, and we're back to these efforts at preventing this from happening in the first place. You want to comment some more on what's going on down there?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. One is, you know, I think we need to continue keeping it on the radar for physicians, pediatricians, OBGYNs. We need to keep talking to women about their drinking behavior. You know, if you're 22 years old and you're not on birth control and you come in for your annual visit, doctors should talk with her about what she's doing in terms of her drinking patterns and whether that's putting her at risk for an unplanned pregnancy while she's having your typical maybe college binge drinking patterns. We need to keep doing that. I think people find it a hard topic to talk about, and I think we need to do more. I think we need to not let men off the hook, that if you're a 22-year-old guy who's out partying on Friday and Saturday night, having unprotected sex with a pregnant or a woman who's not using birth control and is obviously drinking as much as you are, it's not really a good thing to be doing. So I'd like to see us do a lot more public education, even in schools and with healthcare providers. And then finally, we need to sort of get to the population that is at higher risk, and that is those who've already engaged in that behavior, which is where my program comes in. We are considered a best practice by SAMHSA for FAS prevention. Health Canada is implementing our program on their Aboriginal population. We have several sites across the country, including new ones coming on board in Michigan and California, as FAS prevention, which is let's get to these moms who are already using during pregnancy and let's turn them around. Let's get them clean and sober and get them the help that they need and make sure their kids get the services that they need.
The attention deficit disorder issue is a huge one in the United States, with arguments that it doesn't exist to it's overdiagnosed. Where do you place fetal alcohol exposure in your mind, knowing what you know, and its relationship to problems with staying on task, being impulsive, which is part of the characteristics of kids with what are being diagnosed as ADD and ADHD?
Well, I think that there's a whole bunch of factors that go into this. First of all, I have a 44-year-old brother and a 12-year-old niece who are both ADHD, and without the magic of Strattera, I'm quite sure the rest of us would go insane with them. They really benefited from medication, so I do believe that there is something called ADD or ADHD, and that it's highly genetic. We also have society now where parents are not necessarily providing as much structure and direct feedback to their kids, and we have kids acting out in classrooms, and teachers are real quick to say, I can't manage this kid in this classroom, give him some medications. So, you know, I think that we really need to use experts in determining whether a child has a neurobehavioral problem, whether it's fetal alcohol effects or ADHD. There are tests that psychologists and psychiatrists use that can be helpful in sort of rooting out all of these things versus seeing a kid that's just out of control and nobody sets limits on him.
So it's, I guess the point is, this is an extremely complex area, especially the neurodevelopmental problems with kids, and lots of variables, some genetic, some environmental impacts make it very difficult to tease out.
Yeah, and which is why I think it's really important for people to ask for help from the people who can really help them do that, rather than just sort of trying to figure it out on their own or telling their kid to get over it.
I'll give you a minute to tell us the most important things you want us to remember today.
Most important thing to remember today is fetal alcohol effects are completely preventable. And so if women can get pregnant, please use don't drink. And if you do drink, please don't get pregnant. And there is no safe amount of alcohol during pregnancy. And as soon as you find out you're pregnant, please stop drinking, because every day that you're sober is going to mean a healthier baby in the long run.
Thanks very much for taking the time. You've been an excellent guest and very informative, and we appreciate your taking the time.
Oh, I'm happy to talk with folks. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.
So, all right.
Thanks to my guest today, Nancy Whitney of the Fetal Alcohol and Drug Unit of the University of Washington School of Medicine. Next week we'll be back, and we're going to be talking about deep vein thrombosis, or blood clots, particularly those in the veins as opposed to arterial problems. We'll be talking about the causes, prevention, and treatment of these problems with Dr. Michael Jaff. Dr. Jaff is the head, or medical director, of the Massachusetts General Hospital Vascular Center. So he's an expert on this area. So tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, August 11th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.